it's easy to miss. You know, it's easy to read this and be like, oh, right, okay, kids in the Christmas pageant, done. But there's so much more to it.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, Peter Orner and I discuss The Loudest Voice by Grace Paley. We are excited and happy to be talking about a Grace Paley story once again, and it's one we bring to you to coincide with the holidays. Shirley Abramowitz is the voice of the title. She is the loudest voice in the school. The sixth grade teacher, Mr. Hilton, knows this about her, indeed summons her and gives her the role of a kind of narrator of the school's Christmas pageant. Never mind that Shirley is Jewish, as are many of the other kids in the program. For her, as we see, it's quite enough to be included, to be counted, to be taken as someone with skills and talents, never a fool, someone with a voice. And that's not even the biggest conflict here. Her mom isn't too thrilled with the way the school makes all the kids participate in the holiday program without considering their religious backgrounds and beliefs. It's a tension that's on a low simmer, but Shirley will have to figure out how to adjust and stay true to who she really is. This story has been often anthologized, but we want to shine a light on its ubiquity, not just as a Christmas story, but as a really great story for any time of the year, any day at all. Because we're talking about Grace Paley, we'll talk about voice. We'll also read a paragraph or two or three. With Paley, you read the words and then you read them aloud and delight in them. So, hello, lonely voices out there. Here's The Loudest Voice by Grace Paley.
I like that you're choosing the holiday stories. Why this one for Christmas? There's a lot of Christmas stories out there. Why the Jewish Christmas story?
It's just such a great story, and I think people love this story. I love it too.
Yeah.
There's just so much to it, and it's ostensibly just like this little story, but it's really not. It's pretty heavy, actually.
Yeah, I think you're right. I know this is a story that appears in some anthologies and things like that, and I wonder if, like, out of context of a book of Paley's voice, it would get almost drowned out by other stories of the, you know, about Christmas and stuff. And I don't know, I just think that it's easy to miss. You know, it's easy to read this and be like, oh, right, okay, kids in the Christmas pageant, done. But there's so much more to it. There's so much more to it. And I mean, in terms of just like the technical things, you know, this is from Paley's first book where she just burst out of the gate. I was looking back at Saul Bellow's letters, which can be very, very cranky. And towards the end of his life, maybe not even towards the end, but, you know, at a certain point, he became disillusioned with a lot of writers, including Paley, calling them basically limousine liberals, which he was too, I think. But very early on, and I think a letter from the 50s, he just points out that I think the kind of story on her was that she was a housewife and I don't know, wherever she was in Brooklyn, right? And two or three kids, Bellow says, but she's an outstanding writer. And like, she just kind of burst out. And I can see why somebody like him, who has also this bursting voice, you know, on the page, would have been attracted to these early Paley stories. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, her stories only get better. But just, I was trying to imagine what it was like in the late 50s when this book, when she first started appearing, people are like, whoa, you know? So anyway, that's just, I was putting myself in that place of like trying to imagine what it was like to encounter this voice for the first time.
That's so interesting. You know, I'm looking at a lot of Christmas stories lately, just trying to see what's out there. And, you know, it's like the ones people know about, the Truman Capote, the Frank O'Connor Christmas Morning story, and some others, O. Henry, you know, and they're very kind of not so Christmassy. You know, they're very dark. They're about disappointment. They're about, you know, some lesson learned, and it's nothing very festive or upbeat. And I find this one to be very complex, but at the same time has, it isn't such a downer. you know.
No, this is a genuinely uplifting. It's bittersweet. You know, she uses the Christmas pageant to look back at her own life and her own parents, and she talks to the dead. That's how I see this story, and it has this Christmas aspect, but it's even from the very beginning of it, it like I said, it started, you know, speaking to people who are long gone and giving them life again, which, you know, seems like an easy thing to do, but it isn't.
Yeah. You know, the way it starts is it really sets things up in in Shirley's voice and point of view. There's a certain place where dumb waiters boom, doors slam, dishes crash. Every window is a mother's mouth bidding the street shut up, go skate somewhere else, come home. My voice is the loudest. So just from the get-go, it's about this place where there's so much noise, there's so much activity, there's so many things happening. And she's very confident that her voice is the loudest. And she says, "There my own mother is still, as full of breathing as me." And the grocer stands up to speak to her. "Mrs. Abramowitz," he says, "people should not be afraid of their children." The way the story is set up is so, well, it's gorgeous. And it's not very Christmassy, but it just situates us with a lot of the players and with the place and with this kind of recurring situation where she brings us into the red brick building of the school. Every morning, the children stand before it in double lines, which must be straight. They are not insulted. They are waiting anyway. I am usually among them. I am, in fact, the first since I begin with A. And from that point, one page in, a few paragraphs in, then we're introduced to the school. And, you know, we're in it now. We're going to be in the situation where she's being asked to be in the Christmas play because she has such a loud, clear voice. I also like the way this story intersects with the teacher stories we've been doing. And so here's this other teacher also just trying to, you know, cast the play.
What you say about the beginning, I just want to add that, you know, there is a certain place where dumb waiters boom, and that place is gone. That place is long gone. And the place only exists in my head right now. And there is my own mother, as you say, full of breathing as me. And then there's a scene. It's just, it's extraordinary from kind of a general memory or sort of trying to animate her mother's life again. There, my own mother is still as full of breathing as me. And then we slide into scene in the sentence. I don't want to get too wonky, but and grocer stands up to speak to her. "Mrs. Abramowitz," he says, "people should not be afraid of their children." Now we're like, what is going on? Like, there's no context for this at all. We just heard about the dumb waiters and the mother shouting in the street, which is like this general movement back into a place that Paley doesn't tell us, but it doesn't exist anymore. I know it doesn't exist anymore. There's no dumb waiters anymore, right? It's gone. And yet here, by imagining the street and imagining the mothers bidding the kids to come home or bidding the kids to shut up, you know, go skate somewhere else and then come home, my voice is the loudest, meaning that these mothers are yelling at her because she's being too noisy, skating in the street, right? And then we are imagined into this moment with the mother and Mr. Bialik, who says to her, "People should not be afraid of their children." And so we're immediately sort of in a store all of a sudden. Paley does it in a half a sentence. "Ah, Mr. Bialik," my mother replies, "if you say to her or her father, shh, they say, in the grave it will be quiet." So she's like, this kid is noisy, and she's unapologetically so, and also as her dad, right?
Yeah.
And then we're out of scene. "From Coney Island to the cemetery," says my papa, "it's the same subway, it's the same fare." Now, I read that sort of like almost like a disembodied piece of dialogue. It may well have been what the kid says in the store. Doesn't matter to me. But I'm in this universe, you know, and I'm back in time. And it's extraordinarily done in a way that I would think that a lot of people would never notice, you know. And I don't think Paley cares about that. She just wants to immerse you. And then, as you say, get us to the school. Mm-hmm. But I was like, just wanted to linger there a minute because it's like, I've never, there's so few people, if anybody, who can put us in a place so quickly. as she does here.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's linger some more. I am right next to the pickle barrel. My pinky is making tiny whirlpools in the brine. I stop a moment to announce, Campbell's tomato soup, Campbell's vegetable and beef soup. Be quiet, the grocer says the labels are coming off.
Which, the labels on the shelves are like annoying. Even the cans think she's too loud.
And then, yes, and then we get this sort of place that she gives us, and now she's bringing us to a specific scene. One cold morning, the monitor tapped me on the shoulder. Go to room 409, Shirley Abramowitz, he said. I did as I was told. I went in a hurry up a down staircase to room 409, which contained sixth graders. I had to wait at the desk without wiggling until Mr. Hilton, their teacher, had time to speak. After 5 minutes, he said, Shirley?
What?
He said, my, Shirley Abramowitz, they told me you had a particularly loud, clear voice and read with lots of expression. Could that be true? Oh, yes, I whispered. In that case, don't be silly. I might very well be your teacher someday. Speak up, speak up. Yes, I shouted. More like it, he said. Now, Shirley, can you put a ribbon in your hair or a bobby pin? It's too messy. Yes, I bawled. Grace Paley's dialogue. It's Grace Paley.
And I mean, just to go on, we did Yates last time, and I hear a little bit of Yates here, too, and just the paying attention to everything the teacher says, not skimming at all. Now, calm down, he turned to the class. Children, not a sound. Open at page 39. Read till 52. When you finish, start again. He looked me over once more. Now, surely, you know, I suppose, that Christmas is coming. We are preparing a beautiful play. Most of the parts have been given out, but I still need a child with a strong voice, lots of stamina. Do you know what stamina is? You do? Smart kid. You know, I heard you read The Lord is My Shepherd in assembly yesterday. I was very impressed. Wonderful delivered. Mrs. Jordan, your teacher, speaks highly of you. Now listen to me, Shirley Abramowitz. If you want to take the part and be in the play, repeat after me. I swear to work harder than I ever did before. I looked to heaven and said at once, oh, I swear. I kissed my pinky and looked at God. Anyway, so she's in, and then he says, that is an actor's life, my dear. He explained, like a soldier's, never tardy or disobedient to his general, the director. Everything, he said, absolutely everything will depend on you. And she is, we don't quite know this yet, or at least I didn't, that she's the narrator. She's the older voice of Christ, I believe, right? Who's sort of the over... The little boys that are playing Christ, or her voice is sort of over them. We'll get to that. But anyway.
That afternoon, all over the building, children scraped and scrubbed the turkeys and the sheaves of corn off the schoolroom windows. Goodbye, Thanksgiving. It's so Grace Paley, a line. Don't you think?
We've done a Paley show before.
Yeah.
Goodbye and good luck, which is, these last three stories we've done are all stories that I... like have read but haven't been impacted by until you suggested to look at them again. This one definitely, I know I've read it, but it had very little impact on me before. I don't know. I think I was just reading sloppily or fast or whatever, because this is like, and it's got a lot of competition in this book, her first collection, The Little Disturbances of Man, which came out in, 59. And Goodbye and Good Luck is, as we've talked about, is... it is a great one. But in some ways, like technically, this one, some of the things she pulls in here, it's jaw dropping. Like the the kind of risks she takes to lose a reader,
But you just want to keep going. The next morning, a monitor brought red paper and green paper from the office. We made new shapes and hung them on the walls and glued them to the doors. The teachers became happier and happier. Their heads were ringing like the bells of childhood. Oh my God, that line right there. And then my best friend Evie was prone to evil, but she did not get a single demerit for whispering. We learned Holy Night without an error. They're learning all the Christmas songs, Deck the Halls and Hark the Herald Angels. Right. And then, but when my mother heard about it all, she said to my father, Misha, you don't know what's going on there. Kramer is the head of the tickets committee. Who? Asked my father. Kramer? Oh, yes, an active woman. Active. Active has to have a reason. Listen, she said sadly. I'm surprised to see my neighbors making tra-la-la for Christmas.
Any Jewish kid growing up in America, unless they went to kind of an all-Jewish day school or yeshiva or something, has experienced some form of this kind of thing. Even my own kids today. I mean, they don't call it a Christmas pageant anymore, but they always have to balance the 75% of Christmas songs versus a couple of Hanukkah songs and a song for Kwanzaa, et cetera, right? Like, I think here, a lot of readers would be like, aha, she's got it. Like, she's got the conflict, and it's hilarious. But what she does here is so much more complicated than a more obvious conversation that would have happened in, you know, thousands of households across the U.S. at this time. I suppose we're in what? I would say we're in the 40s. But let's say Paley is sort of, remembering her own childhood, which I have no idea if that's true or not. It would have been the 30s, something along those lines. But do you want to read from this section?
Yeah.
So she says, you said it already, but, you know, the Kramer is the head of the ticket committee. And then the mother's like, yeah, I'm surprised my neighbors, in other words, my Jewish neighbors are making tra-la-la for Christmas. And then how does it go after that?
My father couldn't think of what to say to that. Then he decided, you're in America. Clara, you wanted to come here. In Palestine, the Arabs would be eating you alive. Europe, you had pogroms. Argentina is full of Indians. Here, you got Christmas. Some joke, huh? Very funny, Misha. What is becoming of you? If we came to a new country a long time ago to run away from tyrants and instead we fall into a creeping pogrom that our children learn a lot of lies, so what's the joke? Ach, Misha, your idealism is going away. So is your sense of humor. That I never had, but idealism you had a lot of. I'm the same Misha Abramovich. I didn't change an iota. Ask anyone. Only ask me, says my mama. May she rest in peace. I got the answer. Meanwhile, the neighbors had to think of what to say to. Marty's father said, you know, he has a very important part, my boy. Mine also, said Mr. Sarfield. Not my boy, said Mrs. Clegg. I said to him, no, the answer is no. When I say no, I mean no. The rabbi's wife said, it's disgusting. But no one listened to her. Under the narrow sky of God's great wisdom, she wore a strawberry blonde wig. Every day was noisy and full of experience. I was right-hand man, Mr. Hilton said. How could I get along without you, Shirley? He said, your mother and father ought to get down on their knees every night and thank God for giving them a child like you. He also said, you're absolutely a pleasure to work with, my dear, dear child. Sometimes he said, for God's sakes, what did I do with the script? Shirley, Shirley, find it. Then I answered quietly, here it is, Mr. Hilton. Once in a while, when he was very tired, he would cry out, Shirley, I'm just tired of screaming at those kids. Will you tell Ira Pushkov not to come in till Lester points to that star the second time? It's so good. It's just.
She says, Pushkov, what's the matter with you, dope? Mr. Hilton told you 5 times already, don't come in till Lester points to that star the second time. But then there's something that happens here, and I feel like I'm just geeking out on what happens right after that is just like nobody does this. Clara, my father asked, what did she do there till 6 o'clock? She can't even put the plates on the table? That's a whole new scene.
Yeah.
You don't switch scenes from dialogue to dialogue. No, nobody. It's you'd have to be crazy to do that. And yet Paley's like, you know what? In my mind, in my memory, in the way I'm telling this story, the father, I'm at home and I'm not home. I'm still at rehearsal. And my father's asking, she hasn't come home but set the table anymore? And then the mother says, you know, Christmas, my mother said coldly. Ho, ho. And then that changes the father's mind. Ho, ho, my father said, Christmas. What's the harm? After all, history teaches everyone. We learn from reading this holiday, it is a holiday from pagan times, also candles, lights, even Hanukkah. So we learn it's not altogether Christian. So if they think it's a, this is something people would talk about all the time with my growing up. It's like, oh, well, Christmas, you know, the tree isn't weird because pagans did it. Like, and so it's okay. And I've talked about this in many other instances, but I grew up in a town that was, you know, had a fairly significant Jewish population, not as many as people who don't live in the town think live in the town, which has always been an interesting aspect. But, you know, a lot of my friends did not have Christmas trees. We did. We always did. And a lot of my friends would look askance at it, you know? And so And you know, I was proud of it. I mean, my parents were like, look, we're gonna celebrate this commercial holiday and we're gonna join in because it's fun. That's my mother. And you know, my kids would ask, well, is somebody in your family not Jewish? And I'm like, no, we're all Jewish. We just like, my mom liked the tree. We also light the candles too. So suddenly I'm talking as if, you know, and talking in that voice of that isn't even real. There's something about Paley. It's like she seems to create like a universal experience. And I'm feeling that because I experienced something similar. But what she's doing here is far bigger than that. It's far more difficult. It's bringing back a time that didn't exist anymore. Anybody's time, not just this one. And animating it in a way that feels so alive, you know, that no one has to have an experience that's akin to this to get it.
Yeah. I remember you saying...
It's off the rails. I'm not making any sense.
No, it does. I remember you saying something like, nobody talks this way. And then you changed that you clarified what you meant. And you said, she writes the way she hears people and understands them in this world, in this universe that she creates. And somewhere in there, you know, it is resonant. And it just goes back to the idea of the more specific, the more resonant it's going to be.
Absolutely. Yeah, but it isn't a replication. I feel the same way about, and these are, you know, writers that are so dear to me, you know, Malamud and Paley, because they seem to replicate something that other people have experienced. And that sometimes I think goes against it, harder to understand the originality of it. You know, people don't necessarily talk the way they talk in Paley. Only in our memory do they. And most of us don't have any even real memory of that.
Right. Yeah.
This is a creation. It's a fictional creation that I just want to, you know, just to call attention to it. You know, that she's not a tape recorder. This is no tape recorder would have picked up this story.
I feel like, isn't that true of us all? Like in our own situations and families.
Nope. Yeah.
Nobody knows. Yeah, nobody. It's never going to be exact.
Right.
But I really like this next part where the father says, what belongs to history belongs to all men. You want to go back to the Middle Ages? Is it better to shave your head with a secondhand razor? Does it hurt, Shirley, to learn to speak up? It does not. So maybe someday she won't live between the kitchen and the shop. She's not a fool. That's so meaningful to her. I thank you, Papa, for your kindness. It is true about me to this day. I am foolish, but I am not a fool. That's my favorite part.
Why is it your favorite part?
I just like that as a child. She knew that. She knew that she didn't want to be a fool. Even if she was up there and talking so loudly and people thought she was a bit odd, her father's looking at her like she's something. And she knew it. I don't know. I just like that. She just knows who she is.
Yeah, and I just say that she knows who she is now, which is a storyteller. The Shirley O'Bromowitz that has grown up thanking her father in the middle of a story from the future. It's a line that it would have to, you know, again, if you're paying attention, like, she's not a fool. You know, the father gives a speech. She's not a fool, he ends on. So maybe someday she won't live between the kitchen and the shop. She's not a fool. In other words, you know, she's going to embrace this new country and get out of this place we're in right now, between the kitchen and the shop, which is okay, but she can do better, and this kid knows it. And later, from a great distance of decades, I thank you, Papa, for your kindness. You know, I mean, that's what makes a story so beautiful and uplifting and, you know, just like a story we don't, normally, there's been kindness in the last two stories. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you chose to have these three together, it makes a lot of sense to me now. You know, mm-hmm. these are Maxwell's Love, Yeats's Fun with a Stranger, and this one. And there may be, you know, certain stories, maybe a certain era of a different kind of place. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe that's not even true. They're just good.
That night, my father kissed me and said with great interest in my career, Shirley, Tomorrow's your big day, congrats. Save it, my mother said. Then she shut all the windows in order to prevent tonsillitis.
Which is just, you know, I mean, but the timing of that, yeah. I'm harping on Paley as a technical, you know, because I just think it's like, I think she's one of these writers, it happens with Welty too. We take them for granted. I'm looking at Paley's picture on the cover of the collected stories, been reissued a billion times, and she looks like, you know, a nice, quirky old woman on the cover, which I think she, by all accounts, she was some of that. But that, it almost hides the absolute brilliance, you know,
yeah,
of this work. And the timing of that tonsillitis line, it's too funny for us to recognize how extraordinary it is, you know. That's deliberate. Paley did not want us to know how great she was. She just wanted us to be there.
Yes, I think that's so well said. I hate to keep reading instead of talking about the story.
Well, because it's the kind of story where we should just read it.
Yes, and you know, out there on the interwebs, there's audio of Paley reading the story. I think for Vermont Public Radio, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yeah. VPR. Or no, we call it Vermont Public. Not radio, Vermont Public.
In the morning, it snowed. On the street corner, a tree had been decorated for us by a kind city administration. In order to miss its chilly shadow, our neighbors walked 3 blocks east to buy a loaf of bread. The butcher pulled down black windows.
They won't even walk by the Christmas tree that the government has planted, you know, put in there for a little good cheer. They won't even walk by. Some of the neighbors, anyway.
The butcher pulled down black window shades to keep the colored lights from shining on his chickens. Oh, not me. On the way to school with both my hands, I tossed it a kiss of tolerance. Poor thing. It was a stranger in Egypt. I walked straight into the auditorium, past the staring children. Go ahead, Charlie, said the monitors. 4 boys, big for their age, had already started work as propmen and stagehands. Mr. Hilton was very nervous. He was not even happy. Whatever he started to say ended in a sideward look of sadness. He sat slumped in the middle of the first row and asked me to help Miss Glacé. I did this, although she thought my voice too resonant and said, show off. I mean, just imagine. She's about to go on and a student teacher, is treating her so badly. I like this part. Ira, Lester, and Meyer were pasted to their beards by Miss Glacé. She didn't say, you know, they were wearing fake beards or they, you know.
Or their beards were pasted on their chin.
Or their beards were pasted, yes.
They were pasted to their beards.
Jackie Sarfeld, the prettiest boy in first grade, parted the curtains with a skinny elbow and in a high voice sang out, parents, dear, we are here to make a Christmas play in time. It we give in narrative and illustrate with pantomime. She's taking it so seriously, but as she's describing it, it's like, you know, they're pasted into their beards and here's this little skinny, the prettiest boy in the first grade. And it just is what it is. And it just shows that she knows exactly what it is and she knows exactly who's involved and what's going on. The teacher calling her a show off. And she's still going to give it everything, everything.
And this, I mean, how many movies are there where you see the pageant or a kid's play and how cutify it is? You know what I mean? Oh, you know, the parents are in the audience, like this, oh, like shows. This is a trope of some sort.
Yes.
But, you know, in Paley's hands, it was a long story and it was a sad story. I carefully pronounced all the words about my lonesome childhood while little Eddie Bronstein wandered upstage and down with his shepherd's stick looking for sheep. I brought up lonesomeness again and not being understood at all except by some women everybody hated. Eddie was too small for that, and Mardi Gras took his place wearing his father's prayer shawl, which is also pretty hilarious but also accurate, right? I announced 12 friends, and half the boys in the fourth grade gathered round Marty, who stood on the orange crate while my voice harangued. Sorrowful and loud, I declaimed about love and God and man, but because of the terrible deceit of Abby Stock, we came suddenly to a famous moment. Marty, whose remembering tongue I was, just even that, Marty, whose remembering tongue I was, waited at the foot of the cross. He stared desperately at the audience. I groaned, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? The soldiers who were sheiks grabbed poor Marty to pin him up to die, but he wrenched free, turned again to the audience, and spread his arms aloft to show despair and the end. I murmured at the top of my voice. The rest is silence, but as everyone in this room, in this city, in this world knows, I shall have life eternal. And then, in this paley cut, that night, Mrs. Cornblue visited our kitchen for a glass of tea, and Mrs. Cornblue's daughter is Mary in the play, and she had been laying in the straw with Cindy Lou, her favorite doll. Anyway, how's the virgin? Asked my father with a look of concern. I'm not sure about that look of concern, but anyway. And then this is what Mrs. Cornblue says, shoots back. For a man with a daughter, you got a fresh mouth, Abramovich. Anyway, and here my father said kindly, have some lemon, it'll sweeten your disposition. And so they're back, you know, and this story isn't, you know, it ends in the kitchen, and that is such a perfect place mm-hmm. to end, because this story is about the kitchen and about the people in the kitchen. And like I said, who are gone, and just the decency of it. You know, there's a lot of stories that don't have this kind of level of decency. And it's good that we're celebrating this now, because we could use some.
They debated a little in Yiddish, then fell in a puddle of Russian and Polish. What I understood next was my father, who said, still in all, it was certainly a beautiful affair, you have to admit, introducing us to the beliefs of a different culture. Well, yes, said Mrs. Cornblue. The only thing, you know, Charlie Turner, that cute boy in Celia's class, a couple others, they got very small parts or no part at all. In very bad taste, it seemed to me. After all, it's their religion. Ach, explained my mother. What could Mr. Hilton do? They got very small voices. After all, why should they holler? The English language they know from the beginning by heart. They're blonde like angels. You think it's so important they should get in the play? Christmas? The whole piece of goods? They own it.
And I mean, you know, there you have it. It's like you think this story is about one thing. No.
Yeah.
No. It's about this thing, and Bailey's got her eye on it, and her mother, we have her eye on the father because he's so magnanimous and decent, but you know, the mother's like, you're going to cry because the Christian kids didn't get in the play. Forget about it. They own this place. They don't just own Christmas. They own this whole place. You know, the story's not unpolitical. It's complicated. In the part that where the father is trying to defend, you know, assimilation. I mean, that's what the story, you know, is. I mean, I hate to, that's going to academicize it sounding. But it's a subtle and nuanced story about assimilation, rather than what they usually are, very blunt.
But the mother, it's almost like in that little section, the mom is sort of almost defending the daughter. Hey, it's not our fault. Absolutely. They have such small voices, you know.
Right. And look, we're gonna do what we can do. You know, the father and her, the mother come together here in a way.
Yeah.
You know. Different from different directions, but they're both, you know, I mean, it's not easy to explain what the mother is saying here.
And can you read all the way to the end?
Yeah. I listened and listened until I couldn't listen anymore, too sleepy. I climbed out of bed and kneeled. I made a little church of my hands, and I said, oh, hear, O Israel. Then I called out in Yiddish, please, good night, shh. My father said, shh, yourself, and slammed the kitchen door. I have this every night, because when I do the dishes, I have like, you know, I'm listening to NPR, including TPR, or The Daily, or whatever it is, the podcast, and I'm doing the dishes, and my daughter's like, shh, turn that down. Anyway, my father said, shh, yourself, and slammed the kitchen door. I was happy. I fell asleep at once. I had prayed for everybody, my talking family, cousins far away, passerby, and all the lonesome Christians. I expect it to be heard. I would end there, but there is one final line. My voice is certainly the loudest. I would end, I expect it to be heard, but that's a small edit, which is pretty hubristic to cut a line at Grace Paley's. But anyway,
it's so good.
Yeah,
but it is. It's about so many different things, from her sense of herself, her sense in her neighborhood, her sense of herself within the family, within the school, within the play, and within the larger context of not just the holiday, but the world. I mean,
yeah. That larger context is, I think, stories are threatening. You know, they've always been. You know, and the father is trying to say, like, look, don't be so threatened. Don't be so threatened. You know, we can learn other stories. But the mother's like, stories are dangerous. You know,
yeah.
Stories are dangerous. That there's the rub. And I don't think there's an answer here, you know, because we know how dangerous stories can be and how manipulated they can be. And so if only the world was full of people like this father who's like, you know what, I want to learn about other cultures, you know, and I don't even know what I'm trying to say, except that, you know, that if you think about when this story was set, which is around the time of what's happening in Europe in the 30s and 40s, it takes on, I don't know. And in 2025, I read it in a certain way, but also with a great deal of sadness.
Yeah.
Because the father's worldview, you know, even when he says that line, which you read about Arabs killing Jews, and, you know, that reads differently, of course, now than it certainly would have then, you know, and is, I don't know. It's just, you just kind of wonder that an open-hearted piece of work like this has been so swallowed up. Hmm. I don't even know what I'm saying.
No, I hear it. It is an open-hearted story. It is.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a good time for it, but it also feels, drowned out.
Hmm. I got to say, the last few days, thank God for short stories.
Yeah.
Like this one. Grace Paley is the author of The Loudest Voice. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.